You don't have much of a crowd.
No, I'm sorry. My issues are not as interesting as the prior issues, I guess.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jason Ehrenberg on behalf of appellant Leonard Sushanic. The court below committed reversible error in two ways. First, the court concluded without sufficient analysis of the relevant rule of professional conduct that Leonard Sushanic violated what appears to be Rule 1.7 of the D.C. Rules of Professional Conduct in his concurrent representation of Lucy Liu and Kevin So from a period of about mid-August or early September through 2007 through the time he terminated his representation of Mr. So in 2008. Second, the court, we believe, committed reversible error when it ordered Mr. Sushanic, after trial and after ruling in favor of Mr. So, on the conflict issue, to deposit $320,000 that had been held in a bank account, one of Mr. Sushanic's Citibank bank accounts. I'd like to start with the latter issue first, if I may. The law of this circuit. What's
your understanding of the origin of that $320,000?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is your understanding of the origin of that $320,000?
The $320,000, my understanding, was money that Mr. Sushanic had held for a period in a trust account that was the sale of proceeds from an airplane.
So, it was Mr. So's money.
Yes, the issue, though, is not, the issue before the court is not whether Mr. Sushanic improperly held Mr. So's money, or whether Mr. Sushanic should have kept money in a trust account and not switched it back and forth. As Judge Robertson rightly noted, those issues were not before him at trial. The sole issue before him at trial was the fiduciary breach based upon the alleged conflicts of interest. So whether or not the money should have been held in a trust account, or should have been allocated to attorney's fees, or should have been returned outright, as the court rightly noted, is an issue for the D.C. Bar. It certainly was not an issue that was before the court. Although there was evidence discussed, that was not an issue that the court was deciding. That being the case, setting aside whose money that was, it wasn't ordered into the registry because it belonged to Mr. So. It was ordered into the registry because it was part of a judgment that the court rendered in favor of Mr. So based on disgorgement of legal fees. And in so doing, we believe the court disregarded completely the law of this circuit in Price, which unequivocally said that it is settled law that where you seek to reap the benefit of a judgment that is non-divisible, you cannot appeal that judgment at the same time. And doing so will preclude you from doing that.
Price doesn't address the case of someone who is appealing the failure to award additional compensation, right?
No, but Price says where you're Price and Bronson.
We look at what it said in the context. And since the context seems totally different from the context here, it's hard to see that it helps us.
Although Price has been interpreted, by the Fourth Circuit, as well as by court in the Eastern District of Virginia, to be read precisely as we're reading it, that there's nothing separate and divisible about a sum of money. If you are awarded $455,000 and you seek to collect that money, you cannot appeal and ask for a larger pot of money. The Supreme Court's decision in Bronson.
But he's not collecting it. I mean, it's just being held in the registry. Hasn't been given to him.
But by ordering into the registry, it was denying the motion that we filed to stay the effort to collect. So the clear.
Why isn't it just enough that your client just switches these accounts all over the place? He has a long history of doing that, once into his personal account, back into a trust account, another account, and we want to preserve this until the case gets finally decided on appeal. Put it in the registry of the court.
And that's exactly what the court did, and while...
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with that? I don't know.
We believe that's against the law of the circuit. We read Price as saying that unless it's separate and divisible, and such as in a family law matter where there's a custody award and an award of payments of child support, you can continue on with the custody but separately challenge the amount of the child support payment.
Is there any logic to your reading of Price?
Well, it's from the Supreme Court's case in Bronson v. La Crosse, and certainly the Seventh Circuit, as Mr. So has pointed out in his briefing, takes a different view, as does the Fifth Circuit, and I believe the First. The Eleventh Circuit and the Fourth Circuit read Price exactly as we are suggesting it should be read. So there's clearly a circuit split on this issue. Now, this court may disagree with my reading of Price and believe that the law here is contrary to, as I say, but Price has been interpreted not only by the Fourth Circuit, but by courts, the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Were you required to post a bond?
Essentially, yes. The bond being the $320,000.
Yeah, so if in fact you prevailed on your argument here, then before the money was released from the registry of the court, you could be required to post a bond for the full amount, not the 325, the 400 and some, correct?
No, because Mr. So was allowed to, the court order below, only apply to the 320, because that was the money that was in that account. Mr. So was allowed, under the court's ruling, to proceed against Mr. Sushanik in his efforts to collect the remainder of that money.
So you could still be required to post a bond in the amount of 300 and whatever thousand?
Well, I think if we prevail here...
On just this issue?
On just this issue, then I believe the money would be returned, would it not? In essence, the posting of a bond would not be required, because there was a requirement here. Mr. Sushanik was required to post the bond.
I'm thinking of a bifurcated proceeding, because if you lose on the merits, then your argument's moot anyway.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And I guess if I may switch to the merits in the time I have remaining, while certainly there were many allegations and there were a lot of facts presented that pertain to the money shifting between accounts and things of that nature, those are irrelevant to the instant analysis. The instant analysis is whether under Rule 1.7A or B of the D.C. Rules of Professional Responsibility, there was an impermissible conflict of interest. With regard to Mr. So and Ms. Liu, the judge did essentially, the court below, had no analysis other than to find that there was a squabble or some friction based upon an alleged witness statement, that Mr. So never alleged Ms. Wu signed, that Ms. Wu never said she did sign, and that Mr. So was able to, quote-unquote, correct in a proceeding in HSBC London. Now, the comments to Rule 1.7 make very clear that in order for Rule 1.8's prohibition to apply, which is an absolute prohibition, Mr. Sushanik would have had to espouse positions in the same matter. That did not happen here. Mr. Sushanik, if anything, was assisting the lawyers in London administratively. Now, counsel has said the fact that the court found that Mr. Sushanik did not accomplish anything does not help Mr. Sushanik, but it certainly is evidence that he did not espouse a position and that Rule 1.8 does not apply. I would also point the court to Comment 6 to Rule 1.7, which notes that joint representation is commonly provided to parties to a contract, and that is all that happened here. Mr. So and Ms. Liu were parties to a contract, the land-based agreement. HSBC in London sued Mr. So and Ms. Liu and others, seeking a declaration that they did not owe these individuals any money and seeking a declaration that they did not breach any trust to these individuals. Mr. Sushanik's representation related solely to recovery of money for these individuals and to defend these to defend this lawsuit and help establish that HSBC, in fact, was wrong for the financial wrongdoing of a gentleman by the name of Michael Brown. Now, it appears that what troubled the court was that this friction resulted by Mr. So and Ms. Liu taking unreasonable positions. And comment 8 to Rule 1.7 specifically notes that on occasion, a client or clients may adopt unreasonable positions. And a lawyer may be presented with an unreasonable client with unreasonable positions. However, it also notes that not every unreasonable situation arises to a conflict of interest. And that is the case here. Rule 1.7, comment 8 notes that clients have broad discretion to terminate their lawyers. Mr. So never undertook to terminate Mr. Sushanik. Ms. Liu never sought to terminate Mr. Sushanik. Clearly, whatever tension amounted between them, whatever personality conflicts they had, did not warrant withdrawal. It also didn't warrant informed consent, because in fact no conflict arose. Mr. Sushanik was presented with two individuals who had a unified front. The effort was to collect money from a bank in London. There were lawyers representing the individuals in London. There were other lawyers who had represented the individuals in the United States. Mr. Sushanik was presented at the inception of the representation with views and facts that established that these people were on the same team. And even though the court found below that there was some friction that started in August or September, whether it be based upon a witness statement or it be based upon Mr. So and Ms. Liu not liking each other, that just does not amount to a conflict within the meaning.
Did Mr. Sushanik do anything to get to the bottom of the signature on the witness statement?
In fact, he did. Mr. Sushanik's secretary walked through the witness statement with Mr. So line by line, and we point this out in our papers, and asked him to correct whatever was wrong about it. Mr. So also, I'm sorry.
The signing of it,
I don't think he ever got to the bottom of that, but the lawyers in London.
Did he try to get to the bottom of it?
Well, I believe he did. It was addressed with Mr. So. But more importantly.
Well, that goes to the content, but not the signing, which is an independently potentially troubling proposition.
I don't disagree that that could be troubling, but the lawyers in London were the ones that dealt with this issue at the end of the day. They are the ones who put the witness statement into evidence in London, and they are the ones who had Mr. So testify as to the truthfulness of the statements or the falsity of the statements in London. And it's significant to note that in the London litigation, Mr. So did testify that, in fact, he had signed the witness statement, and, in fact, that everything on the witness statement was true, save for the one or two issues about ownership of family businesses, which, while they may have seemed important to Mr. So.
How, of all the lawyers in this country, how does So wind up with Sushanik?
Well, that's something that the court looked at and I think focused on the title that Mr. Sushanik had of Chief Judge Emeritus and Mr. Sushanik's.
Who did the referral?
The referral was through, I believe, people who were affiliated with the Fifth Avenue Partners, which was the land base agreement. So I believe
the land base agreement is the hub of the fraud against So.
Michael Brown is the hub of the land base. It was argued by HSBC.
And Sushanik issues an opinion. Did he draft part of this agreement too?
His testimony was that he did not. Yeah. I believe one of the solicitors in London argued that he had drafted it. He said
certainly issued an opinion dealing with it.
He issued an opinion, and that was the second conflict.
And he never advised his client that he had this prior involvement.
That's correct.
And he never advised his client of any potential claims that his client had against LandBase.
That's correct.
And that occurred, the failure to inform occurred throughout his entire representation of SO, not just for a month or a two-month or a three-month period, it was throughout the entire representation.
Well, I believe the evidence in the record established that during the summer or fall of 2007, Mr. Sushana came into possession of tapes that did establish, in his view, that SO and Lou might have claims against LandBase relating to the warranty provision, or excuse me, the indemnification.
No, I'm not talking about, but he never disclosed the material, and that occurred during the entire representation period, during which he received some of it not authorized, more than $1 million in legal fees, correct?
Well, again, when you're saying not authorized, I don't think that evidence was clear. I don't think the judge made findings. The judge did say that he paid himself. The judge didn't say that
paid
it was
himself,
unauthorized.
Yeah, but there is some evidence that he never, that SO never authorized payments.
I think when focusing on the conflict, my reading of the court's decision is that the LandBase conflict, that the conflict, to the extent it existed at the inception, before the agreement was SO and Lou was signed, or the potential conflict that should have been disclosed and waived, and that that was for about a one-month period of time, and that after that, I understand Your Honor is saying that that there was no disclosure, but the disgorgement award was based upon.
And I come back to my original question: were the individuals who were behind the LandBase scheme, are they the ones that referred SO to Sushanik?
Well, you're saying LandBase scheme.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been any finding that by this court that there was a scheme. There was a finding that through the LandBase documents,
call it what you will, the individuals behind it, were they the ones that referred SO to Sushanik?
No, Michael Brown is the individual in London.
But there were others.
There were others, but they were not parties to the London litigation.
What I'm asking. I'm asking whether those others are the ones that referred SO to Sushanik, because they have had a relationship with Sushanik, either in the opinion letter or in the actual drafting of the document.
I believe that they referred Lucy Liu to Sushanik, and Lucy Liu, and by they, I'm not agreeing that they were behind anything. Boris Lopatin and LandBase, that was the investment vehicle that SO and Liu signed and put their money into. And through HSBC's doing and through the doing of Michael Brown, who was not part of Boris Lopatin and LandBase, Michael Brown was able to take this money. Now,
and did Sushanik receive any legal fees from those, either LandBase or those affiliated in one way or another with LandBase during the time of his representation of SO?
I don't believe so. I believe he received the fees he received at the beginning of that representation. I don't know that there was evidence in the record about when he was paid, but once SO and Liu signed an agreement, he terminated the representation of LandBase before SO and Liu signed an agreement. I think
I'm holding you up way past your time.
Sure. Okay. If I may just clarify one point, just with regard to LandBase and Lopatin and Brown, the allegation in the London litigation was that HSBC argued that it was not responsible for the wrongdoing of Michael Brown. HSBC argued that there was money laundering evident in these contracts that Judge Sushanik had reviewed as part of its effort to not be responsible. But these other people in these contracts and LandBase were never made party to the litigation, and there was never a finding of any money laundering scheme. That was just an allegation.
All right, Mr. Tripp.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Tripp, and I represent Kevin So. to pick up on a couple of the issues that came up in my opposing counsel's comments, it was Boris Lopatin who referred Judge Suhanik to Lucy Liu, who then told Wang about it, who then told So about it. And that is how Kevin So came to hire Mr. Suhanik. Mr. Lopatin said that Mr. Suhanik was a very powerful U.S. judge, and didn't mention the fact that the judge had been retired, and in fact had not even been a federal judge, but had been an administrative judge. This was a finding by the district court, and there is actually a chain of resumes being forwarded along this chain to support it. I also wanted to mention that Lopatin did pay fees to Suhanik, and in fact, some of those fees went directly to pay for the services provided by the gentleman who was doing the searching for Mr. Brown's money. But it was clear that money was definitely being forwarded through by Mr. Lopatin to Mr. Suhanik at the same time that he was representing Mr. So. He began representing Mr. Lopatin about 3 weeks before he represented So, but there were documents in the record, which the court acknowledged, which show that he had been representing Suhanik for many years prior to that. He, in fact, had endorsed.
Who had been representing whom?
He had been representing Mr. Lopatin. And Mr. Lopatin is the owner of Landbase. And Landbase was one of the participants in the fraud. Landbase was the creator of the Landbase agreement, which the court found was the reason why Mr. So lost his $30 million. And so there was an obvious conflict here. There was a terrific conflict here, and the court acknowledged it. And the district court said that it was inconceivable that Judge Suhanik, or Mr. Suhanik, could have been opining in his land-based opinion about the fact that there were no there was no effect of this of the I'm sorry, there was no it was impossible for him to have not recognized that the land-based opinion was basically saying that Mr. Lopatin, land-based, had no responsibility for Sahanik's loss of money. So at one point, he's telling Mr. Suhanik, he's telling Mr. So, that he is going to find every person who's liable to him and responsible to him as part of his representation. That's in his engagement letter. And at the same time, he's telling Mr. Lopatin that he's going to defend him against these claims that they were responsible for laundering money and other illegal activities. There was this clear, inconsistent goals between these two clients that Mr. Suhanik should have known from the very first day he agreed to represent So. With regard to the conflict between Mr. So and Ms. Liu was the person who was the investment advisor. She was the person who brought Mr. So to the fraud. She was the one who advised him to invest in it. She had, at one point, obtained power of attorney to sign the land-based opinion on his behalf. And Mr. Suhanik should have recognized that there was a conflict between these two people. It's like when a husband and wife who are involved in a car accident come to a lawyer and they say, we want you to represent both of us against the other driver. That lawyer has an obligation to turn to the wife who was the passenger and say, you ought to consider the fact that you may have a claim against your husband if at the end of the day he turns out to be negligent. Did those two people present themselves as a team? Of course they do. But it's the lawyer's job to see beyond that sense of teaming and to identify whether there are any claims that these two individuals might have against each other and to discuss these claims and see whether they can clear the conflict. Now, if the wife is willing to, waive her claims against her husband, yes, the lawyer can represent both of them. But it is unacceptable. In this case, Mr. Suhanik never even met with Mr. So. He asked, according to his testimony, he asked Ms. Liu, do you think Mr. So has any conflicts with you? And she says, no. I mean, that's absurd. And the expert witness who testified at the district court found that to be absurd.
In your briefs before us, did you make the point that Judge Randolph made earlier, that the non-disclosure of the relationship with of the giving the opinion for land base continued for the whole period of the representation?
That's correct. That's correct.
You made that point in your brief?
That the fact that he didn't disclose the land base opinion to Mr. So?
Right.
I do not make that in my brief, I believe. There was conflicting testimony on the subject, and it was not a finding by the district court. Mr. Sahanek insisted, I believe, that he had shown So a copy of it. So insisted he never saw it.
I thought your brief did make a representation several times that the conflict, to the extent there was a conflict, that continued throughout the entire representation.
It definitely did, sir. I believe that if we're talking now about the land base So conflict, I believe that that conflict, well, that was found by the court to have existed from the very beginning.
Right.
And the only real question is whether Sahanek sending a termination letter to Lopatin saying, I'm no longer representing you, had any effect. And that's when we get into the issue of the hot potato rule. And my point about that is...
Well, then I don't understand your answer to Judge Williams.
I think Judge Williams' question to me was, did Mr. Sahanek ever tell So about the existence of the opinion that he wrote?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is, Mr. So says he never did. And I believe Mr. Sahanek may have testified that he did tell him, but that's not inconsistent with the other issue. I think that the single most important question that is presented in this case is whether and under what circumstances a court can order disgorgement of less than all legal fees when it's confronted with a lawyer who has breached his fiduciary duties and has done so in bad faith. And there is many elements of bad faith in this case that I've identified in the brief. In Hendry v. Pelland, the court doesn't answer this question. It's an open question that's left over from that decision. The concern, obviously, is that Hendry versus Pelland does say that damages aren't a necessary element of finding a breach of fiduciary duty. But if a judge is allowed to simply say, I think this is a $400,000 case, like he did in this case, there is a danger that the judge is at least considering in the back of his mind whether and to what extent the client has been damaged. And so you're bringing in through the back door the whole idea of damages, which Hendry versus Pelland says shouldn't be an element in these cases. The cases that are cited by Hendry v. Pelland, which talk about whether and when to disgorge all legal fees, there are cases that are from the Tenth Circuit, and there's Gilchrist, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court. What those cases all basically identify is that if there is bad faith, then there should be total disgorgement. Our position is that there was bad faith in this case, and there should be total disgorgement. One of the cases I cite to you is a case called Rash out of the Tenth Circuit. And that relies upon the decision of the Texas Supreme Court in Burroughs versus Archie. Archie, it's a 1999 Texas Supreme Court decision. And that case identifies that, yes, there should be complete disgorgement. However, there are areas of judicial discretion which might reduce it. For example, if the court feels like that the client is going to obtain a windfall if complete disgorgement is allowed, or if the client has deliberately, for example, learned of the problem and sat back, allowed the lawyer to work for years and years, and then claims a right to disgorgement. Those would be circumstances in which a court could say, even though there was bad faith, we're not going to disgorge all the fees. But that is not the situation we have here. Nor do we have a situation here, as was identified in Pelland, where there might be an apportionment formula that could be used, where you could say, well, you know, this client was with this lawyer for 10 years, but the bad faith and the breach of fiduciary duties didn't occur until the seventh year. And so, therefore, we're only going to disgorge fees after the seventh year. That's, again, not relevant here, because here we have bad faith and we have conflicts of interest that existed from the very beginning of Mr. So's representation.
What did So lose in total?
He lost, in terms of, in the fraud, sir? He lost $30 million, of which $10 million was recovered from the bank accounts that had been put into the registry of the UK court. So at the end of the day, he lost roughly $20 million.
And there was an expert that calculated the total amount of fees that Suchanek received from So.
That's correct.
And there was $1.1 million something, right?
Well, the total amount of fees was $1.1 million. That was not based upon my expert's testimony. It was based upon Mr. Sahanek's own accounting. In paragraph 42 of the district court's finding.
Is that a contested number?
It is not a contested number. It's based upon the accounting, which is cited in paragraph 42 of the district court's memorandum of decision. So our position is that he should be entitled to disgorgement of the $99,000 retainer that he paid Mr. Sahanek at the beginning, and the million, I think it was $247,000, that he paid himself during this period, and that the district court found that he paid
himself.
What
is the effect of the bankruptcy proceeding in the Eastern District of Virginia?
The bankruptcy proceeding has one implication. There has been an adversary proceeding filed in that case, which has challenged the question of the money, the $320,000 that is in the district court's registry. That money, you correctly identified, was money that had been paid to Mr. Sahanek in trust. It was proceeds that the UK court had ordered be paid to Mr. So. $808,000 was paid from the sale of that airplane on December 7th, 2007, into Mr. So's trust account. On December 12th, 2007, just a few days later, Sahanek removed that money and put it into his business account, and then lied to Soho about the fact that, telling Soho that the money was still in his trust account, and then moves the money again. At the beginning, it moves the money from account to account, and then places it, what was left of the money, he'd spent part of it, places the $320,000 back into the a trust account the day after we filed our district court lawsuit. So before trial, we filed a motion with the court to freeze those accounts, which was granted. And when the district court issued its decision, it ordered that money could not be used by Sahanek for anything other than paying our judgment. When we tried to enforce our judgment, that is when Mr. Ehrenberg went and tried to obtain a stay. And one of the arguments that was made was that if Mr. So took the money back to China and Mr. Sahanek won his appeal, he'd never be able to get the money back. And that's why the district court fashioned the remedy rather than giving the money to So.
It's the bankruptcy proceeding is by Sahanek?
Yes, yes. And what he has done...
It's a personal bankruptcy?
Yes, it is. And what he has done is that he has filed an adversary proceeding, which says basically that the money was a preference because the money was transferred into the registry of the court within 90 days of the day he filed for bankruptcy. Our position is that the money was never Sahanek's to begin with and should not be subject to it, and that should be, it's not property of the estate.
Thank you.
I assume you're making claims of that sort with respect to other accounts of Suchanek.
I beg your pardon?
Your argument that it was never Suchanek's would seem, if I understand the matter, to apply not only to $320,000, but to other accounts, which we don't have before us,
that's
of
correct.
Suchanek, right?
That's correct.
If there aren't any questions.
Thank you.
Fine. All right. Give us a reason.
What? I don't want
to. Do you have a question?
Oh, I thought we usually gave him a couple of minutes.
No. Do you have a question?
All right.
We're done.
Yeah, I've actually seen them do that. Okay. This is note two.
Okay.